Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 42, section 8, which is old single column, page 478. All right. So recall the tour de force that was last session. We made our way through section 7 that was entitled Atomic Matter, where they were dealing with the basic overall issues, some trying to give us some of the anchor points to be able to zero in on a proper model for an atom, but with one key ingredient missing, you know, which is what this next section is devoted solely to. The whole issue of why does an atom stay together in the first place? Okay? You know, what kind of glue holds an atom together? If you are familiar at all with, you know, kind of just in popular literature context, you know, TV programs or whatnot about current ideas about the atom, the nucleus of the atom, the particles in the nucleus, you know, the so-called particles in the nucleus, the protons and the neutrons. Now they're supposedly made out of quarks and all that. You know, they literally use an idea for holding these so-called quarks inside of the protons and neutrons together. They call the particle, the virtual particle, basically, the particle that holds those quarks together, gluons, right? Talking about, what's the glue that holds things together? I mean, that's just a basic question that everyone asks, whether or not they're, you know, 100 times smarter than anyone in the room or not. Right? It's a basic question. What's the glue that holds things together? Okay? And rather than, you know, getting fancy, just, you know, name something in that regard. Okay, but there aren't actually quarks, so you don't need gluons to hold quarks together. And there aren't actually protons and neutrons in the nucleus. So you don't need a strong nuclear force to hold those protons and neutrons together. So the really primary work that's being done by current scientists to figure out what holds this thing together is all a non-issue. And since they did away with the literalness of electrons going around the nucleus, you know, they really did away with the question of, you know, what holds the little electron billiard balls around the nucleus. You know, if you don't have billiard balls to hold around, you don't need to, you know, dream up some mechanism. So, you know, you have a very convoluted picture in current science. But because, like I said, the main focus in current science is on the nucleus and all of this fancy effort to rationalize what, you know, what they think is going on there, if you have any exposure to that, you read the title of this section, Atomic Cohesion, and that's where your mind is going to be. You're going to be thinking, oh yeah, that whole thing about, you know, what holds the nucleus together, that cohesion. Because that's the primary cohesion that they're thinking about. You know? Any sort of an electron cohesion is very secondary. Okay, but notice that the word in front of cohesion is not nuclear. Okay, it's atomic. Mm-hmm. If you don't let that firmly sink in, as you start reading this section, when you get in a little ways, you'll be easily diverted onto a false tangent by what they say. Okay? So you have to make sure that you're not unwittingly caught up in the way we've all been indoctrinated growing up and how we're educated about the nature of an atom. Okay, and this section is one of the classic examples of the pattern that I've pointed out before, where they have a twofold desire in play. One, they want to tell you make some direct comments of a revelatory nature, and second, they want to point to something that we're thinking about right now and comment on it. You know, so you know, it's sort of, you know, here's the way you should start genuinely thinking about it. Here's, you know, and then second, here's how you're thinking about part of it now. Have you thought about tweaking your perspective, you know, such, you know, from that to, you know, a slightly different angle? Okay, so that basic pattern, again, and if you haven't noticed that pattern, you can get tripped up. Remember how we saw that very definitively in the last two paragraphs of section 6. It was just a two-paragraph example of that. A first paragraph, you know, which has been very misunderstood and hence modified even, you know, that is what's giving you the direct revelatory content, and then a subsequent paragraph, the last paragraph of the section, that was, you know, very much picking up on some thoughts in human source work and tweaking them. You know, so you've thought about it like this, have you thought about, you know, modifying it in this way? This section 8 is where I first recognized that pattern, because it's just the most very definitive example of it in the book. It taught me to start looking for that, and then I, you know, discovered they do it in lots of places. Okay, so you see how that is indicated in the text. You have a whole collection of paragraphs, but there's a large paragraph break after the first two paragraphs. See that big break after the second paragraph? Right, so you have two paragraphs and a break, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs. Okay, see, that's where the two parts are divided. You know, that large paragraph break is trying to suggest something to you, you know, that there is some differential between those two parts of the section. Every little detail is significant. So the first two little paragraphs are the direct revelatory comments, where they're sort of speaking to more in a more of a philosophic mode about actual reality. And then we're going to see how they're going to leverage off of some human thoughts in the latter part of the section. Okay, so let's see what they have to say about atomic cohesion.
8, atomic cohesion. While gravity is one of several factors concerned in holding together a tiny atomic energy system, there is also present in and among these basic physical units a powerful and unknown energy. The secret of their basic constitution and ultimate behavior, a force which remains to be discovered on Urantia. This universal influence permeates all the space embraced within this tiny energy organization.
All right. Now, let's step through it. One thing just to note, if I hadn't, you know, primed you to be really thinking, this is not really speaking to how we think about things right now. But if you weren't in that mode and you were grasping, trying to rationalize what they're saying into what you've heard about current theories? When you see this issue about some very powerful and unknown force which remains to be discovered, thinking, oh well, you know, this is, you know, way back when we didn't have any idea of quarks and gluons and the strong force and all of that, you know, maybe they're talking about that. Well, if you know anything about any sort of nuclear or quark sort of theory about binding things together, you know that that's a very, very short range phenomenon that they assume. Okay, so when they say the last thing, that this universal influence permeates all the space embraced within the tiny energy organization, if by energy organization you were thinking the whole atom, you go, well, it can't be that, because it doesn't even make it outside of the nucleus, this nuclear force. It's so short range, this force they've dreamt up. It's like, well, okay, but maybe they're just talking about the nucleus. See, and that would really start to get you away from the atom. The electrons would disappear in your mind, and you'd be all focused in on the nucleus, just to try to kind of rationalize what's being said there. But that's not what's going on, okay? And, you know, one thing that should tell you that is the second word. While gravity is one of several factors concerned in holding together a tiny atomic energy system, when you read that from a current perspective, you have, two options. Either you decide whoever wrote this is a complete blithering idiot, and never even took high school physics. Or this is talking about something very different than what anyone thinks about right now. This is a revelatory part. So when they say gravity, do they mean the kind of gravity that if I, drop this, cup of tea in front of me, it falls to the floor? Do they mean that kind of simple linear gravity? No, they mean the inwardness phenomenon that they keep pointing to. And we've seen that. While gravity is one of several factors, we talked about, you get up to element number 100, try to go beyond that, and it's going to be net outward, okay? So we've seen how you definitely have this issue of inward and outward, thinking about that in a very general sense about the atom. It obviously can't be cohering, can't be stable if it's a net outward phenomenon. Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. That's not the primary thing here, as you can tell from that sentence. It's just one of several. And then they go on to say, there is also present in, this really significant, important phenomenon. That's what they're wanting to focus on. So you have an atomic system that's a net inward phenomenon. So it's fundamentally stable. But you're just wondering, why does it remain so constant? Why doesn't it collapse to a point? And if you believe in black holes, why doesn't it collapse into a black hole and disappear from the universe? Or, why do these electrons stay at a certain distance away from the nucleus? All these issues. Why is it a stable phenomenon? Okay. And they're saying that fact results from, its stability. That stability results from something that is currently completely unknown in current thinking. As we said, almost all the time when they say that, they're talking about the subelectronic. We've mentioned this over and over again as we've been going through this paper. We're now going to focus in a little more precisely on how to start thinking about what's going on of a subelectronic nature inside the spherical volume of space that encompasses all of these particles and their relationships. Okay. This universal influence permeates all the space embraced within the tiny energy organization. Okay, so it's when you notice they said powerful and unknown energy, and then they said a force. They're batting it back and forth between the words energy and force because they want you to think about the full complexity. You have the force charge, which initially is permeating the whole space, and then, like we said, there's all the things that happened upon that foundation. Okay, and they're about to point to that in the next little paragraph, a little more specifically about what they want you to start thinking about.
So it's not the force charge we're talking about.
Right. Remember, the force charge doesn't hold anything together. It's not a force like we think of forces in current physics.
We were talking last week about it is where waves are created by a...
Waves?
Travel in the force charge.
I mean, waves are distortions of the force charge in space, you know, of the primordial force.
The
force charge is the medium.
When there would be a wave.
Right. A wave has to have a medium, you know, that's waving, that's undulating, you know, and it's the force charge that's undulating. right, so there's going to be that, but, you know, as they're always telling us that, you know, you always have more than just wave phenomena when you're talking about the subelectronic, and you need to think about the whole package. Let's see. Okay, so anything else there? Let me just say, you know, one other little thing, prime for the next paragraph. As I mentioned up front, you know, this issue that disappeared really from consideration when you dropped trying to rationalize the atom in a solar system-like way, where you tried to picture electrons literally as little planet-like objects going around a nucleus. And when that model disappeared, you know, which is basically the Bohr model, or variations of the Bohr model of the atom from way back at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, that any sort of consideration of, you know, of how you stably keep electrons going around a positive nucleus, you know, see, pretty much went away. And, you know, like I said, everything focused on trying to keep the billiard balls together in the nucleus that they were assuming were there. Well, you know, we don't have that problem. There's only one particle in the nucleus, so there's, you know, there's not two particles to hold together. The real question is, you know, how do you keep the electrons stably orbiting this positively charged nucleus? Okay. That's what we're going to be talking about. Yeah. All right, so you see how, you know, you immediately can, you're directed towards that by the very first thing they say in the next paragraph.
The inter-electronic space of an atom is not empty. Throughout an atom, this inter-electronic space is activated by wave-like manifestations, which are perfectly synchronized with electronic velocity in ultimatonic revolutions. This force is not wholly dominated by your recognized laws of positive and negative attraction. Its behavior is therefore sometimes unpredictable. This unnamed influence seems to be a space force reaction of the unqualified absolute.
Okay, so that last little bit we touched upon last time. Remember how they, you know, were saying that right in that last paragraph of the previous section. You know, we're not going to try to figure out all of the inscrutabilities of this very complex system combined with an infinitely more complex environment, and, you know, and how that's fundamentally, you know, underneath all of that, underlying all of that is the unqualified absolute, you know, or the functioning of the facet of deity. You know, the infinite capacity, all those inscrutable issues. I mean, even taking it to the Almighty, you know, is inscrutable. Okay, let's try to we just want to focus in on what's basically going on in the atom that might be, you know, tweaked and modified by other complex issues. But, you know, what's the starting point fact that we're trying to understand here? Okay, see, so, you know. You know, they say inter-electronic, right? Between the electrons. You know? And even if you're thinking in the more general sense of the word electronic, where it means any electronic level particle, you know, there's only one in the nucleus. You know, the nucleus is one particle, so there's no inter. You know, to that, you know, it's between the nucleus and the electrons, and between all the electrons. We're talking about that whole vast space, you know, which is a big space. Remember, in the previous section, they tried to point out even for element number 100 with the innermost orbit, you know, which is pushing in close, It's the same relative space that you have between the surface of the sun and the orbit of Mercury. Okay, so, you know, okay, there's a lot of relative room. Okay. All right, so that whole space is not empty. All right, so throughout an atom, this inter-electronic space is activated by wave-like manifestations. Okay, we've mentioned that several times, that those electrons are in very rapid motion. They're made out of ultimatons. Those ultimatons are coupled to the force charge. So there are waves being generated in the force charge. There's this complex standing wave phenomenon that is set up that diffuses a lot of the energy of the electron throughout the whole region of space, which is why our current ideas of smearing the electron all over have some validity. Because the inter-electronic space of an atom is not empty. Okay? You know, when you assume it's empty, like we do now, and yet not empty, you know, you have a very magical not emptiness, you know, in the current theory. Okay, but this is a literal not emptiness. I mean, the force charge is throughout all that, and it's and all these wave-like manifestations are set up in that space. Now, one of the key things of thinking about waves, and they mentioned back a ways in the paper, when you're dealing with that sort of a phenomenon where you don't literally have, you know, little collections of 100 ultimatons, you don't have little billiard ball-like things that can't be on top of each other. They can't be at the same place at the same time. This whole inter-electronic space can have all kinds of things happening within it at the same time, superimposed. You know, even if you're just thinking in simple wave sense, two waves can superimpose and make a double height wave. Okay, so they're reminding you that wave-like, so that you liberate yourself from trying to think, well, if I put one of those things in there, I got to worry that it doesn't bump into one of those other things. Yeah, you know, you can put a whole bunch of these things we're going to think about, all this sub-electronic stuff in there, and it's all superimposed on top of each other, you know, on top of itself. Okay, and then a little clue about what to think about being in there. They say, okay, wave-like manifestations, which are perfectly synchronized with two things. Electronic velocity, for one thing. Okay, and I was sort of just alluding to that. I mean, if we have these electrons moving around in orbits at high velocity, you know, so that part is very much kind of just related to having waves in there that are of the same momentum, you know, magnitude as the electron, you know, itself, and spreading that oomph of the electron around. But they throw in another thing that we haven't, you know, brought up. And ultimatonic revolutions, perfectly synchronized with ultimatonic revolutions. Remember how when they brought that up a couple sections back, right? Yeah, a couple sections back. They pointed out that all of the phenomena that we observe of a particle, you know, its mass, its charge, etc., even its size, has to do with those axial revolutions of the ultimatons. You know, they're together in this complex hundredfold system. And varying that complex hundredfold system, making the axial revolutions greater, lesser, related in all kinds of different ways that we can't even imagine, produces all of these complexities of charge and its different magnitudes, you know, mass and its different magnitudes, all of the various symmetries of the particles. Okay. Yep.
This is within a particle.
Right, so that's within a particle. That you know, like within an electron, you've got all that complexity I just said, like, you know, producing the charge of the electron. Right? Inside the nucleus, you have all that complexity I was just talking about, producing the charge of the nucleus and its mass and all of its various properties. But it doesn't just stay in the billiard balls. Okay? That is reflected out into the inter-electronic space. So within that the space between the electrons, there's phenomena going on that have to do with ultimate atomic revolutions, you know, that reflect that fact. Like there's going to be, for instance, a charge-like phenomenon, and then a basic energy-like phenomenon in there, similar to what particles have, only those motions that give you the basic energy nature of a particle, the charge of the particle, those energies are not wrapped around a collection of 100 ultimatons so that it's an electronic level phenomenon. It's just out there in the inter-electronic space. Yes?
Well, isn't the electronic aspect of it due to the photons getting within the particle?
No. Okay, so the electronic aspect, he's wondering about what the electronic aspect is due. It's just what I was just saying there. When we're talking about the electronic level, the base of that phenomenon, is a collection of 100 ultimatons. To say something is at the electronic level, it means you're starting with a collection of 100 ultimatons, a particle, you know, in a full-blown sense, 100 ultimatons in a completed particle. You're starting with that particle and then augmenting on it. If you just have the kind of stuff that you augment on that, but it's not on a base like that, if it's just in the space between, it's sub-electronic.
Meaning not necessarily 100?
No, it means there's not, you're not talking about ultimatons at all. Okay? We're not talking about energy that's trying to be wrapped around a collection of 100 ultimatons. We're talking about motions. Remember, all these energies are motions. We're talking about a motion that isn't wrapped around a particle. We're talking about the motions that are in the inter-electronic space. And they're motions that are like the motions that are wrapped around the particles. Because like they're saying, it's perfectly synchronized. These motions in the inter-electronic space are perfectly synchronized with those motions of the particles, which are generated by the ultimatons.
Because if they weren't, it would break them all apart, right?
Well, if it wasn't perfectly synchronized, you would have no way to do what we're about to figure out. You'd have no way to have the atom be stable. You'd have no way to hold the electrons in relationship to the proton-like, you know, the positively charged nucleus.
So, Chris,
yep.
I have a question.
Yep.
The ultimaton is basically a straightforward revelation, correct? I mean, we didn't really know about it. The whole 100 ultimatons.
Right. I mean, we have no imaginings about non-electronic level phenomena.
Right. So that's something that you learned from reading
right. There's nothing in anything that anyone has ever thought that is even remotely suggestive of ultimatons. Even the wildest goofball theory, you know, by someone on the internet or something, is not.
Here
it's
again,
all electronic level thoughts.
Not as directly as they tell us about the ultimaton, but they're telling us about this atomic cohesive integrity, they call it later on. Mm-hmm. You're describing a little bit, in which is going to. Theoretically, I guess, is leading up to another basic revelation, correct?
Right. So, I mean, think about what we're trying to build up to. They seem to be taking us back to kind of a billiard ball model, where we had a nucleus that was like a ball, and then a bunch of little balls, electrons, going around it. Okay? And we're wanting to know what glues this collection of particles together. Okay? Is it some magical thing like, you know, Newtonian gravity, where you have action at a distance? You know, in a Newtonian gravity sense, it's all very magical. You've got the sun and the earth, say, separated by a vacuum. And in some mysterious way, the sun reaches out and grabs a hold of the earth and says, I want you to go around and around me. Okay? It's not like it's, you know, Newton said that it sets up a wire, you know, between the sun and the earth, and it sends messages along the wire, you know, or something like that. You know, it was called action at a distance, and it was very controversial when he introduced it because it seemed illogical. You know, how on earth, you know, could there be some communication between the sun and the earth when there's nothing being communicated?
And there's nothing.
Okay.
There.
How could you talk on the phone if there wasn't a phone?
Or a line.
Right. Nothing. No phones, no lines, no nothing.
Space.
Right? Just empty space.
Sometimes.
Okay. You know, but you do the basic equation assumptions of it, and you can calculate the solar system, and it all works fine. But you have this kind of nagging mystery of exactly how logically you understand the Newtonian gravitational phenomenon works. Okay. Now, since then, we've dreamt up two different ways of handling this sort of problem with gravity. You know, we dreamt up this notion that space-time was a substance and it was curved and stuff. And so, you know, the space-time is what goes between the sun and the earth so that the earth knows about what the sun wants to tell it. The sun alters the space-time and that spans the distance between the sun and the earth, right? See, so there's something in between the two of them to link them together. You know, so it's at least a little more reasonable assumption. Now you've got something between the two. Okay? See, we're doing the same thing here. We're trying to figure out what's in between the nucleus and the electrons so that they can communicate with each other. How do they know each other's there? Okay? If you don't have the kind of forces that we currently picture, going back to starting with Newton, if you don't have the Newton-like Coulomb force, you know, where you have the same action at a distance, you've heard about that idea of a Coulomb force, an electrostatic force, where you have opposite charges and they attract. Well, they attract in the same magical action at a distance way. You know, there's no wire connecting a positive charge to a negative charge. It just was action at a distance, just like Newtonian gravity. Well, since then they've dreamt up an idea where, well, let's actually imagine that something gets passed between the two things. Okay, and in the case of electrostatics like that, the idea is that you pass a photon. It's not an actual photon; it's a virtual photon, but at least that's better than nothing. You know, you're trying to imagine in some way that the two are interacting. Okay, so this is the key thing. Rather than having magical action at a distance forces, you have forces. So that when they talk about forces now, they talk about four. They talk about the strong force, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, and gravity, gravitational force. And one of the ways they rationalize all four of those forces is as an interaction. There's something passed between the two objects so that there's a communication. They're interacting. You know, they're talking to each other in some way so that the one knows what the other wants it to do. Okay? An interaction model of forces. Okay, we're about to see that when we get to the latter part of this section, another interaction model of a force. Okay? There's obviously some logic to that. Like we were saying, I mean, to believe that two things can relate to one another, but our island universes is illogical. I mean, there has to be something, you know, between the two of them. So that's what we're developing here. They're saying, yes, there literally is, this inner electronic space of an atom is not empty. Okay, so you don't need some magical rationalization scheme. You've got all kinds of possibilities for a message to go from point A to point B, to go from the nucleus to the electron. between from electron to electron. You've got a medium to pass a message through. Okay. All right. So that that's the basic idea. Now, what a little bit more specifically are they suggesting? Okay. Before we it's going to be a while yet. Yeah. Hold on just a second. I need to set this up a lot. I mean, they're two tiny little paragraphs, but if we don't get some sense of what the revelation is trying to explain to us, there's nothing we can do with the human thoughts that are about to follow here. Okay, so what is the basic idea that we have in mind here? Recall that we touched upon this back in the end of section 6 when we were looking at that mysterious paragraph that had been modified. Because it just was, no one could make any sense out of it, so they changed the words until it made sense. Remember, that was a revelatory paragraph. And how did we resolve that? That first part of that, when it said that it's supposed to say, while an electron weighs a little less than 1/2000th of the smallest atom hydrogen. Okay, and we said, okay, if I take the billiard ball model, the smallest atom hydrogen is composed of a proton and an electron. The two together are 1,837. The proton's 1,836 plus one electron. So the whole atom together is 1,837 times, more massive than the electron. And we're going, 1,837 is smaller than 2,000, so it shouldn't be less than. It should be more than. If you think in the billiard ball model. But that's what we're trying to get away from. What's really going on? I'll go back through what I said back then to properly interpret that. Okay, without getting into any gritty details, start with the picture of an electron going around a proton, just that simple smallest atom of hydrogen, the one that's called protium. In contrast to deuterium and tritium, the single proton, single electron hydrogen. So you have that electron in a simple model, you got the electron going around the proton. Okay, what actually happens with this inter-electronic space, that space between the proton and the electron, is there's an energy that gets set up in that space, a motion that gets set up in that space between the proton and the electron, that is such that a bit of energy and charge-like nature are in that motion, and that the charge-like motion of the electron is not with the electron. That charge-like motion of that electron is in that subelectronic motion that's between the two of them. So that what you effectively end up with is a proton, this energy motion that's not wrapped around a particle, so it's just subelectronic, but it has the kind of motions that a certain particle has. In the revelation, we're going to call that particle-like motion a mesotron. Okay? We're just about to read. So you have a proton, which is an actual particle with some motions associated with the particle itself. Then you've got some motions that we're going to call a mesotron that isn't actually a particle. It's just these motions in the inter-electronic space. And then we have this electron. It's not an electron anymore because its charge part, it's been modified. Most importantly, its charge part is now in the mesotron, and it's a neutral fact. It's what we call an electron neutrino. Okay, this is the way you're going to modify that hydrogen atom. So instead of having two things, two balls, two charges, one of them, the electron is not going to have a charge, and it's going to be massless, I mean, like a neutrino. There's going to be the charge-like motion in the mesotron, but it's not wrapped around particles, so it's not going to have mass. So the mesotron doesn't have mass, okay, and that neutrino doesn't have mass. Okay, but that hydrogen atom in that picture has a total energy. It has the energy that we recognize of the proton, you know, which manifests as its E equals mc squared sort of mass. You know, that much energy. And then they're going to tell us in this section we're reading here how much energy to give to this motion that's in the inter-electronic space, this mesotron. They said, give it a tenth of what you give the proton. Okay, and then there's no energy attached to that, what's now effectively a neutrino.
It used to be
an electron. And I'll explain some of the issues here in a second. But the point is to, they want you to say, see, while an electron weighs, okay, and by weighs, you know, we mean, I want you to compare the amount of energy, motion, you know, that's with the electron, compared to the amount of motion that's in the proton and the mesotron. So you add those two together, and instead of having the 1837 we had before, now we have 2020. Yeah, which is bigger than 2,000. Hence the less, a little less than 1 over 2,000. If you recall, that's the way we understood that sentence properly before. Okay, that what they're telling you is that they want you to compare how much of this particle-like motion you have in relationship between the electron and the combination of the proton and the mesotron. Okay, that's what we're thinking about in detail now, is that system where we don't just have a, you know, take the simplest one just to, you know, just think about initially here, back to section 8. So instead of thinking about an electron going around a proton nucleus for a hydrogen atom, think about how some of that, the ultimatonic revolution, see, like, you know, that ultimatonic revolution in that electron that was giving it its charge, that charge kind of motion is now out in the space between. Okay? Okay, so this force is not wholly dominated by your recognized laws of positive and negative attraction. Notice how this phenomenon I'm describing is overriding, you know, having this charge just attached to the billiard balls. It's taking that charge-like motion and saying, well, I'm not going to allow you to just be wrapped around that electron particle, you know, that collection of 100 ultimatons. I'm going to use you in a bigger context, you charge-like motion. See? That it's perfectly synchronized, see this, with that. And so that charge-like motion is not just all localized, it's spread out. Which again, see, speaks to one of the ways that current science plays with the current atom. Sometimes to get a correct answer, they'll speak of having a charge distributed throughout the whole volume. See, there's some truth to that. It's not like you have little micro billiard balls, you know, like pixie dust spread all over, charge distributed everywhere. You know, charge is a motion. You know, and this motion is now within the, you know, is now associated with the whole atomic system, not just with one of its particles. That's what's happened when this electron has become bound to the nucleus. The motions that were, you know, just separately in the two are now being shared within the whole system. This sharing is what's gluing it together. Okay? And we'll get a little bit more specific on that in a second. But see, it's now if you take what they had apart and share it amongst them, then they're obviously someone's going to have to do something to break them apart, because you know they can't just take their balls and go home very easily. You know, they don't have all of them in their hands. You know, it's being shared all over. Okay, so that's what's going on here. They're trying to get us to think about this modified picture. Okay.
This may be a stupid question, but somebody busted me for asking too many questions. So does that possibly mean that electricity is not the flow of electrons?
Right. So another thing that, you know, you can eventually come around to solid state physics, and you know the fact that we just are making this atom less of a simple billiard ball picture. Think about how billiard ball you rationalized current in a wire. You know, now initially when they discovered electricity and started studying, you know, flowing in wires and stuff like this, they didn't assume that electricity was electrons, you know, flowing through a wire. Okay. But then once you discovered electrons, you go, oh, well, we could rationalize it that way. We could make electrons flowing through a wire. Okay, you know, but they didn't discover electrons until the end of the 19th century. They were playing with current long before that. Okay. So, so this starts to get you thinking. It's like, maybe I need to go back and rethink a whole bunch of things. You know, what actually is current? Okay, just because I can increase a voltage and make a spark come off a wire, and you know, and I can check what's going on inside that spark, and I can discover its electrons. Just because there's electrons that fly out of the wire doesn't mean the electrons had to be going through the wire. It could be some motion in the wire, and if you do something to liberate some of that motion, you know, it could wrap around an electronic level base and leave as an electron. See, once you let go of the billiard ball model, there's all kinds of possibilities. Okay? So, yeah, I mean, most likely, current is not at all what we think it is in terms of a flow of charges. You know, or take something like magnetism, you know, where the only way they can rationalize magnetism is they have to make charges move, because a moving charge generates a magnetic field. A magnetic phenomena is a motion. You don't have to have moving billiard balls. You just need that kind of motion. So there's probably all kinds of ways to understand these things that we haven't even begun to imagine. Right? It just throws open the doors on all of the fundamental questions. You go back to the beginning and don't make the same assumptions they made way back at the very beginning of all these branches of physics and chemistry. Okay, let's see here. Okay, a question on the webinar.
So how is this new understanding of true physics going to change the direction Uranch is currently going in? Why would they spend time in the papers on this?
Well, biggest picture, you would like one day to have a genuinely advancing civilization. There's no way to have a genuinely advancing civilization without true religion. Okay, you know, you're just gonna have primitive, superstitious civilization, quote unquote. You know, semi-civilized at best. Okay, without true religion. Well, you can't have true religion without true science and true philosophy. So what you're moving towards is having a complete logical reality. You know, it's not that initially you're going to need to know how to calculate the spin of a lithium nucleus in order to figure out if God loves you or not.
Thank God for that.
Okay. But if you're going to have some idea besides just your wishful thinking ideas of God, okay, the kind of ideas of God that you're going to have once you leave Gerizim, okay, that right now, I mean, right now if they tried to teach you what they teach you on Gerizim, you would be bored out of your mind. You know, the things they would be teaching you about God and you would fall asleep because it would be so boring. Because it wouldn't have anything to do with all of our wonderful, fanciful sorts of notions that we have in our heads. It would be a physics of God. Okay. It would be the Total Deity seminar on steroids. Right? Total Deity stuff is children. That's what they teach in kindergarten. Right. Okay. So think what you'll be learning in Havona. Okay. Right. I mean, all this stuff that is so beyond what our mind can even begin to deal with, you know, if they were speaking to us about it, we would all just go catatonic. Okay, we're so completely immature, there's no way we could even relate. It would just be blah, 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 blah. It would be meaningless blather to us. It wouldn't mean anything. You know, all you could see is they were excited about it, and so you'd try to be excited too, like a little kid, you know, but you have no idea what mom and dad are talking about. Okay. All right, so, I mean, it's what they're trying to get this process going, okay? Because in the age of light and life, there are no ignorant people. They've been all been eliminated from the gene pool a long time ago, okay? There's no ignorance in light and life. Everyone in light and life is, remember, if any of us were put on a planet in light and life, any of us, we would be immediately put in a hermetically sealed container, okay? I mean, soundproof and everything, because any thought in our head, any aspect of our bodies is just a contagion, okay? I mean, you know, why when a rebellion starts, the Most High is clamped down the communication grid, okay? I mean, nothing that we have going on in our head right now is even remotely valid, you know, in an age of light and life, or appropriate for someone going to the constellation level. It's not, it won't, you know, we can't even get to the fifth mansion world, you know, even remotely with what we've got in our heads right now.
But developmentally right now, it's perfect for us.
Right. It's all relative to now, just appropriate, completely appropriate. We're not inadequate for this planet, but we're inadequate for paradise and Havona and Uversa and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But we're not inadequate for this short little ignorant life. Okay. Right now. But again, you know, once you're settled in a world is settled in light and life, it's a lot more like those worlds on high. And we're completely inadequate for that.
Well, Jesus certainly didn't think so when he came here.
Well, Jesus was not trying to make a world, you know, did he leave a world in light and life? No.
No, but he came here because he cared about us.
Right. Again, see, that's what I'm saying. I mean, can we separate our ignorance from God's love? You know, we like to glue them together so that, you know, we have to believe that we're all wise or God doesn't love us. No, separate the two. Separate the spiritual and the material. You're dumb as a fence post, every one of us. I mean, I struggle endlessly with how hopelessly ignorant I am, okay? But God loves me absolutely. He doesn't love me because I'm smart, you know, or pretty, or whatever. Okay? He's not my material father, or even my mindal father. He's my spiritual father. Okay? And my body and my thoughts are not what he loves. He loves something that I really don't know yet. This, you know, my spiritual nature, which is transcendent of my day-to-day thoughts. Okay? But that's not the case forever. In an age of light and life, those people are cosmic phenomena. You know, they're just as, you know, the kind of definitive spiritual nature that God loves has an equal mindal and material nature harmonized with it. So this revelation is trying to get this process started. It doesn't expect everyone on the planet to be ready for this, right? But it's trying to get the process started. All right.
That's a good explanation for that question.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yes, there's a lot of theatrics going on outside, so yes.
Remember, it's energy, mind, and matter. We got to have a little,
energy. A little bit of energy.
Okay, all right, so enough said, I think. Let's see, make sure I got everything out there. We got off on that tangent. So the basic picture that we're wanting to think about. Yeah, is this kind of motion that we're going to call a mesotron associated with the nucleus? Okay, and as we move into the rest of this section, yeah.
One quick question: the mesotron is not a particle; it's the motion.
I'm about to explain that a little bit better.
What has nothing to do with waves?
We don't need to really think too much in detail about exactly what it is. Just don't think of it as a particle. Think about it as an amount of energy that's within the atom. It's within the space of the atom. There's this energy that's not a little billiard ball rattling around in there. Okay. Yep.
I don't think we got to the heart of William's question. He wants to know, how's the new understanding of true physics going to change the direction of
right. Okay. I mean, once we have, you know, once you develop a truer physics, you know, you'll revolutionize, you know, life on the planet in terms of our material existence. You'll immediately have all kinds of wonderful technology, anti-gravity technology, and all kinds of wonderful things. We won't be groping around, you know, worrying about energy crises and things like this. You know, all that stuff will go away. But one of the reasons we have all these difficulties still is because we still need them to be motivated. You know, if they handed all of resolved all our difficulties for us as primitive as we are, you know, we'd all just turn into blobs of protoplasm laying there like a boneless chicken ranch, you know. It would not be a pretty sight. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, telling you the last thing you want to do until you're moving way into an advancing stage is take away the profit motive. I mean, you can forget, you know, no one will get up in the morning. Okay?
Right?
I mean, yeah, if we don't have these basic driving influences, you know, when we're this primitive, you know, nothing's going to happen. You know? So if we aren't worried, you know, that, you know, we're all going to starve to death because we don't have power or something like that, you know, none of us are going to get to it and try to figure out, you know, ways to deal with that problem. Okay, now, where this is going next is, they're going to give us a series of thoughts that are in parallel to a human source work. It's a simple little, I have a Xerox copy of it here, it's a simple little two-page article in Scientific American. Okay, that was published in October of 1940. Okay, so this is also, you know, one of the really easy to determine chunks of text that were put into the revelation during the third phase. You know, you have the initial phase, the first phase, when there's nothing being given into the revelation, and they're just trying to sort out the details with the contact commission, and for those papers that they're going to have to use a contact personality for, you know, the handful of papers they need a contact personality for, they got to find a stable contact personality. All those issues, they're working out those technical details. And then the second phase is when they're actually giving the bulk of the revelation, and that takes you up to 1935. And then after 1935, until they cut it off, you know, there were little modifications that were made. And this is one. The revelators were waiting till kind of the last minute for us to get some content that they could leverage off of to give us a few more clues about this alternative model of the atom that we're talking about here. And we came up with something relative to the nucleus that that they could leverage off of. The article in Scientific American was called The Evanescent Mesotron. Evanescent, that it comes into existence and quickly fades away. You know, it's just this blip. You know, the reason that the author named it that is not only that when they were being observed in cosmic radiation, they were very short-lived phenomenon, but they began to use them to rationalize the nucleus, holding the protons and neutrons that they believed were in the nucleus together. And they were going to have this virtual particle, this thing that just sort of blips in and blips out of existence in a fraction, tiny, tiny fraction of a second. You know, so it's evanescent. Here today, gone, here one instant, gone the next instant. And the background here is, in 1936 and 37, just after they'd kind of finished up the bulk of the revelation, some guys were doing some cosmic ray measurements, experiments, on top of Pikes Peak, actually. So here in Colorado. And they started to notice some particles they were detecting that didn't seem to be protons or electrons. They seemed to be something that was in between, in mass. Okay. And by 1937, it was pretty definite that there were these intermediate mass particles, more massive than an electron, not as massive as a proton. They still were very fuzzy on exactly how massive it was and stuff. But they were working hard to try to pin this down. And by the time you get to the end of 1938, it's pretty definitively been decided to call this new particle a mesotron. The MESO, Greek for middle. Right? So it's between the electron and the proton in mass. Okay. Now, almost immediately after that, within a year, there were those that were saying, "Well, maybe we shouldn't call it a mesotron because that's really kind of an abuse of the Greek language." Shouldn't we call it a meson? Okay, shouldn't we take the meso prefix, drop the O because we're going to put an O-N suffix after it? Drop the O for a vowel, and it's just going to be meson. Shouldn't we call it meson instead of, isn't it more properly called meson instead of mesotron? Because, the TR, the guy that coined the mesotron, he was thinking electron, taking the TRON. Okay, but the TR is not actually part of the suffix. The O, the TR is part of, like, electric, and drop the IC, and then add ON. Okay, so people are saying, yeah, it's really kind of an improper word. So definitely, things were beginning to shift. By the time October of 1940 rolled around, and this thing was, there were those that were starting to call them mesons instead of mesotrons. But the mesotron term hung around for a while. Okay, and now you've got the revelators, setting it in stone, using the term in a revelation, which they know is going to have consequences. But it works. Because back there, starting in 36 and going forward over the ensuing years, what they were actually measuring, what they discovered, once we started calling them mesons, is what came to be called a mu, the Greek letter mu, mu meson. And this, and they also began to discover that this wasn't the particle they'd hoped for. The particle that they could use to rationalize gluing the protons and neutrons in the nucleus together. An idea that was first put forward in publication in 35. This idea of having an intermediate mass particle to glue the protons and neutrons in the nucleus together. What we're going to read about here. Because this mu meson didn't interact with protons and neutrons. Like, they needed a particle that did that. Well, they didn't actually find that particle until 1947. It came to be called the pi meson. It's another reason to use the word meson instead of mesotron. See, when you had two of them, you wanted to call them both mesons and distinguish them. One was mu and one was pi. And in 1950, they discovered that pi meson had a neutral one. It wasn't just positive and negative charge like the mu meson. There was a positive, negative, and a neutral one. And this was something that they were needing too, as we'll read about in a minute here. And so finally, when you get to, all the way into 1947, 1950, you finally have discovered the particles that they were actually looking for all along. The thing to rationalize gluing the protons and neutrons together. Okay, so now in that regard, when I was just talking about these motions that we're calling a mesotron, they're the motions of a pi meson. Oh, I should mention that, and then to shorten them in more recent times, instead of calling them mu mesons and pi mesons, they just call them muons and pions. Okay, those are the current names. Okay, so I'll use pion. I've mentioned that I've figured out what the motions are of these basic particles. This mesotron, what we're going to use in the inter-electronic space, this sub-electronic phenomenon, it's going to have the same motions as a pion. Okay, but not wrapped around a particle, so it's not actually a free particle. It's just part of the energy system of this atom. And this is important to give you all these details, because once we finally discovered the pion and kind of pinned down how massive it was, we figured out that it's 273 times as heavy as an electron. 273. And that early particle that they could tell was close to 200, which is kind of what they were looking for. They thought they were looking for something that was kind of close to 200. And this seemed to be really close to 200, and that's why they originally thought that was what they were looking for. The muon, it came to be known as the muon, it's 207 times, once we finally pinned down how much it was. Okay, as you look in this first paragraph here that we're going to read, you can see the number 180 in there. And I was mentioning that 1/10 of the proton, 1/10 of 1836. Okay. This Scientific American article uses that number, 180, for the mesotron, which is very mysterious, because definitely by the time 1940 had rolled around, this mysterious particle, which is actually the muon, that they were calling the mesotron, they knew it was at least 200 times. So why the author of this article chose 180 is mysterious. The most you can imagine is what later, in the article he mentions the proton ratio, and he just calls it 1800, rounds it to like that. And so maybe he thought, well, maybe it's, it'd be kind of fun just to make it 180, you know, tenth of 1800.
His colleagues would call him.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's kind of weird. But it is just a Scientific American article, so they probably gave him a pass on it. It's not like a Referee Journal article, you know. Okay. But the Revelators, okay, the Revelators aren't just going to, you know, they're not just going off on some false tangent like this, okay? What are they, what, you know, they're going to use this 180. And they're leveraging off of that article probably first and foremost because of that number in it. You know, and the fact that we know that the basic physical phenomena is tenfold in nature. And we shouldn't be surprised at all, even if you don't understand the physics yet, if this energy system that we're going to call a mesotron is exactly one-tenth relative to a proton. Okay. And then on top of that, like I was saying before, if you think about the electron around the proton billiard ball model being modified so that basically the charge aspect of that electron goes into this mesotron, calling it a mesotron instead of a meson, you know, sort of reusing the word mesotron reminds you of how it's related to an electron. It's taking the part of the motion of the electron and putting it into this inter-electronic motion. You know, and you can continue to call those other things mesons, like muons and pions, the free particles. This is not a free particle. It's not even a particle rattling around in the, you know, it's just motion.
How do they identify it then?
Oh, no, what scientists identify are particles.
Yeah.
Okay? And what they identify for the pion is 273 times more massive right. than the electron, not 180.
Right. Okay.
Right? This is the difference. When you're just dealing with the motions, and they're not wrapped around a particle and off free by themselves, it's not 273, it's just 180. The Revelators are trying to teach us this. They found an article, see, that uses this 180. That motion, you know, it's you know, you don't want to think of a pion rattling around inside the nucleus. Because if you put a pion inside of a hydrogen atom, then the hydrogen atom would weigh, you know, a whole bunch more than it weighs. It wouldn't have the mass of 1,837. It would have 1,837 plus 273. Okay? And that wouldn't agree with any observation. Right? Remember, you know, we can't just assume anything here. For, you know, it's got to agree with, when we weigh a hydrogen atom, you know, it doesn't weigh, it doesn't even weigh 2020. It weighs 1837. You know, that's like I was saying, we're not talking about, the weight is still the weight, you know, in terms of the mass. But this motion, how much motion there is what we're talking about here. Okay, I know that was a lot.
No.
Okay.
It's not enough.
Okay, what else on the webinar there?
So in order to see the mesotron, if Japanese Hideki Yukawa, thank you,
yeah.
1935, named it, would his authorship in Human Source Works be in the UB? Was he Japanese, and did he translate it into English in order for his source work to be?
Yukawa, like I said, he published that in 1935. That was that initial theory about what the nuclear force, okay, and you know, he didn't have the word mesotron or anything like that. You know, he was thinking that his virtual particle that we're about to read about, you know, should be something like 200 times the mass of the electron. Okay, and that's why I said people were looking for something about that. And they were finding something, because 207 is about 200, see, so, you know, especially when they can't quite pin down what the mass is, you know, they go, oh, this, you know, this muon, you know, is it. Okay, but again, the whole point is, you know, what Yukawa is talking about doesn't exist. There aren't protons and neutrons in the nucleus, and so none of that theory means anything. Okay, but the spirit of the idea can be used. That's what we're about to read here. So let's start reading this.
One more question. If any of the human source work is present in the book, are the human sources, are any of the human sources still alive today?
Yeah, I mean, there are source authors that are still alive, I believe, yeah. But obviously fewer and fewer because this stuff is getting pretty old. Okay, so let's read that first little paragraph there. Okay.
The charged protons and the uncharged neutrons of the nucleus of the atom are held together by the reciprocating function of the mesotron, a particle of matter 180 times as heavy as the electron. Without this arrangement, the electric charge carried by the protons would be disruptive of the atomic nucleus.
Okay. So you're going, okay, so why do we care about a statement like that? Okay, what the revelators are doing here in these paragraphs, they're literally just going parallel through that article and making comments, you know, like these four paragraphs, and they'll make a little comment, you know, these two paragraphs, and they'll make a little comment, you know, they're just following it in order. So they take the first part of the article, and they make this little paragraph, you know, including directly the 180. I mean, those words are, you know, 180 times as heavy as the electron. If you look in here, and then I lost it, where did it go? Now I can't find it. It says that directly in here. Why in the heck can't I? Oh, yeah, there it is. He says about 180 times as heavy as an electron. You know, see, it's word for word, see? 180 times as heavy as an electron. And see, so that, you know, they're taking little snippets like that. And, okay, so you're going, well, okay, there aren't protons and neutrons in the nucleus, so, you know, what's the point of this? Okay, remember what we said up front. The whole point is to transition your thinking from trying to figure out what holds the billiard balls and the nucleus together to what holds the atom together. What holds the electrons in relationship to the nucleus? Okay, the charged, you know, nucleus, and you know, instead of the charged protons, and the electrons of the atom are held together by the reciprocating function of the mesotron, a particle of matter 180 times as heavy as the electron. Just rework the sentence. And instead of making the sentence about something going on between protons and neutrons, make it be between the nucleus and the electrons, okay? And then it's true.
So this is true here?
No, what's in the book is not, you know, what's in the book is telling you, here's something you think right now. You think about a nucleus of protons and neutrons. The way you're thinking about that with this mesotron, think in that same way about the relationship of the nucleus to the electrons. Okay, so it is this new model of the atom that they're trying to get you to think of. It is the case that the nucleus and the electrons are held together by the reciprocating function of the mesotron.
That's true.
That's true. Okay? And it's a particle, you know, the amount of energy in that is 180. So like we can add it to 1800, you know, 1836 and 184 and get 2020 like we did before, okay? Okay, now, and then it says, without this arrangement, the electric charge carried by the protons would be disruptive of the atomic nucleus. Okay, well, we don't have that actual thing. What's the truth flowing through that if we just modify the picture? Without this arrangement, the electric charge carried by the electrons would be disruptive of the atom. Okay, why? Okay, if you you have a central a Coulomb force, an electrostatic force, where you can write down the equations, and just like you make mercury go around the sun, you can make an electron go around that proton. You know, it works just exactly like gravity does. It's just a 1 over r squared central force, and this thing goes into orbit about it. But there's a problem. Unlike mercury going around the sun, the electron is a charge. And when a charge accelerates, it radiates energy. Yeah. Mercury is not charged, it's neutral. Okay? That charged electron, if you construct an analogous solar system-like thing out of, with an electron going around a proton, that electron, see, is going in a curved path. It's accelerating. Okay? And so it would radiate energy, and it would spiral in to the nucleus in short order. You know, as it radiates away energy, it drops deeper down into the potential well of this central force, you know, picture here, and it just spiral into the nucleus. Instantaneously, okay. You know, just like if a satellite is losing some of its energy because of drag in the upper atmosphere, it spirals into the Earth, right? Okay, that electron would spiral in. You know, so atoms would last a fraction of a second. Okay, none of them would last any time at all. And so that's why one of the reasons why they gave up that model of the atom, because we carefully watch atoms and they don't radiate energy and they also are stable, they don't collapse. Okay, so the model even though you can make it in orbit, if you it only works if you close your eyes to that bit of physics that accelerating charges radiate. Okay, so. But they're bringing us back to the billiard ball model. They want us to have an electron in a defined orbit going around a nucleus. It's like, well, I've got the same problem then. It's not going to be stable. The electric charge carried by the electrons would be disruptive of the atom. Do you want to shift? No, no. I'm rewording the sentence. Okay, I'm changing the sentence.
How can you do that?
Because I'm showing you. Okay, because. The point is not, they're not trying to tell you that what this guy wrote in Scientific American in 1940 is true in the literal sense, okay? It's true in a bigger sense. Use the idea of the pion-like motion to stabilize the real atom, okay?
Yeah, but nobody's going to know that.
I do.
But you're the only one.
Not anymore. I'm talking to people all over the world right now. Okay? Okay, if you want to use... Okay, remember, this is what the revelators are doing. They're saying, here's how you think about the nucleus right now. Have you thought about it like this? Have you thought about not using those same thoughts, but not in the nucleus, but in the atom itself? Bringing the electrons back into existence instead of making them magical things that don't actually exist. Put real electrons in the atom again. Face the problem again of how do you make the atom stable if you have actual electrons in there? Why doesn't it radiate away energy and indicate nothing?
Mesotron.
Okay? And the secret is this mesotron. Okay? And in the next paragraph, we'll see it a little bit more, but let me just give you a first hint of this. If what you're really... have, in a sense, is not an electron going around, but a neutrino going around, and the charge part of the electron is now in the motion of the mesotron, okay, you don't have the problem of a charged particle going in a circle and accelerating. The neutrino is not charged. Okay, so it's not going to radiate away energy. I know there's some other issues, but just that's the first thing to just recognize. If I take the charge out, away from that particle, so I don't have this charged particle going in a circle, radiating away energy and spiraling in and disrupting the atom, then I don't have that stability issue. I can make a stable planetary-like atom again. if I use the mesotron idea? Okay, it's like, well, a little bit more specific. How should I use that mesotron idea? Okay, so they go further in the article, and the article goes into one of the exciting things about this new mesotron, you know, back in 1940, was using it to rationalize holding the nucleus together. Okay, and so they have a paragraph paralleling that. Let's read that paragraph and then show you what you should think about it.
As atoms are constituted, neither electric nor gravitational forces could hold the nucleus together. The integrity of the nucleus is maintained by the reciprocal cohering function of the mesotron, which is able to hold charged and uncharged particles together because of superior force mass power and by the further function of causing protons and neutrons constantly to change places. The mesotron causes the electric charge of the nuclear particles to be incessantly tossed back and forth between protons and neutrons. At one infinitesimal part of a second, a given nuclear particle is a charged proton and the next an uncharged neutron. And these alternations of energy status are so unbelievably rapid that the electric charge is deprived of all opportunity to function as a disruptive influence. Thus, does the mesotron function as an energy carrier particle, which mightily contributes to the nuclear stability of the atom?
Okay, so let's start with the billiard ball model of the nucleus. Figure out what it is that the relatives are paralleling. I say, okay, you think about the nucleus like this right now, and in October of 1940, you were excited about this new way of resolving the issue of why doesn't this billiard ball nucleus fly apart? Because at that point, we were constructing the nucleus out of protons and neutrons, because we'd finally discovered the neutron, so we stuck it in there. Okay, but we have this problem. You know, we have a certain number of protons and neutrons, a certain number of protons to get the correct charge, and then add a number of neutrons to finally get the correct mass. It's like, okay, so I've got the correct charge and the correct mass, but I've got a problem. All the protons are the same charge, and like charges repel. And these like charges are very, very close to one another. You know, 10 to the minus 15 meters apart. Okay, really close. So that, you know, Coulomb repulsion is very strong. Why, you know, if I magically cram them all together into that tiny little ball, the second I let go of them, they go pew, fly off in every direction. Okay. Why do they stay there? Well, Yukawa, as you know, mentioned there on the webinar, and then going forward, as this guy in this Scientific American article is describing, a physicist came up with this idea of how to rationalize that problem away. You know, if you have a positive proton that wants to fly off relative to the other protons in the nucleus, you know, which is the same charge. So it's going, I'm the same charge, I'm going to fly away. Oops, no, now I'm a neutron. Okay, I guess I'm okay. Oops, now I'm a positron, now I'm a proton, I want to fly. Oh, no, now I'm a neutron. Before, you know, it starts to get the idea of flying away, but before it can act upon that thought, you know, we're anthropomorphizing here, it's turned into a neutron. And so it doesn't fly away. So if you just, you know, in split seconds, constantly, these things are being changed from protons to neutrons, and from neutrons to protons. It makes it so that doesn't fly apart. And on top of it, in ways that are a little hard to understand, it acts like a glue. It doesn't just keep them from flying apart, it also glues them together. In this way of, there's this exchange particle, okay?
Does inner force of gravity help and do that too? Or?
No, gravity does nothing. You know, even in this article, he starts out saying that as atoms are constituted, neither electric or gravitational forces could hold the nucleus together. You know, he basically says something like that in the article.
But the first sentence is
okay. No. The first sentence of this paragraph.
Oh, I meant the very first sentence of the section.
That's different. Okay. Now we're just trying to understand the billiard ball model. Okay. And they're trying to, they have these protons that are going to fly apart, and they got to keep them together. Okay. And so in this theory, if you work through the mathematics of this theory, this passing these mesotrons back and forth, it actually works as a glue. And just think about it in the sense of, say there's some sort of way that they can interact, the way they could be drawn towards each other, but they've got to, one particle has to tell the other particle, come hither. Okay, it passes a mesotron, which has that message in it. It's like a message in a bottle. Passes it, the other particle opens up the bottle and reads the message and says, oh, come hither, so it does. Okay. These intermediary particles like this carry the information about the force. In the article, he has the word carry in quotes. Okay? The revelators put it in quotes just so you can make it easier to find the source article, nothing else. But they add energy inside the quotes. So rather than thinking of it the way the author was a carrier of force, this strong force, this nuclear force, it's going to be a carrier of energy. Okay, like I was saying, the actual mesotron that we're going to think of is not a particle, but it's these motions, this intra-atomic motion, an energy. It carries energy. Okay. And in particular, it's carrying the charge-like energy from the electron. Okay, so that's the nucleus thing that they're pointing at. They say, okay, now here's your idea about the nucleus. Now, think about that basic idea. Now, what if you took the spirit of that idea and applied it to the atom? That's what they're trying to get you to do. Instead of trying to rationalize why the nucleus is held together, which you don't have to rationalize because it's one particle, how do you keep the electrons around the nucleus? Okay, so let's just think about it in the simple billiard ball way. Again, if I have a negatively charged electron going around a positively charged proton, I've got this problem that it would radiate energy and spiral in, and that would be the end of the atom. Well, what if I did a similar thing? So you imagine the electron is trying to go a little distance around its orbit. Okay? It's trying to go a little distance around its orbit. Okay? And it's thinking, I'm going to radiate because I'm accelerating. Okay? And I'm going to move in towards the nucleus. I'm going to start spiraling in. It starts to get that thought of radiating and spiraling inward. Okay, but then the mesotron goes from the electron towards the proton. It converts the electron into a, when it leaves the electron, it leaves a neutrino behind. And if we do it in a simple billiard ball model, that mesotron would turn the proton into a neutron. So instead of having an electron going around a proton, you would have a neutrino going around a neutron. Neither of those things are charged. So when it's in that state, a neutrino relative to a neutron in the center, there's no charge, opposite charges. There's no spiraling in. So it would go, oh, well, we're okay. But now, the neutrino is like, well, I'm out of here. So it's going to just start to go off on a tangent. But before it can get really off on a tangent, the pion goes the opposite direction and turns it back into a proton and electron again. The pion goes the opposite direction, or the mesotron, we should really say mesotron. The mesotron goes the opposite direction and leaves behind a proton, turns the neutrino back into an electron. Okay? And then then it's doing it again. So see, it's like, okay, I'm gonna start to spiral in, no, I'm gonna fly away. No, I'm gonna spiral in, no, I'm gonna fly away. Now I'm going to spiral in, now I'm going to fly away. So it goes around.
Yeah. It's not in.
Okay. That's what's actually going on. That's why you can have a planetary model atom. Okay. Now, and if you don't think of it in such simple billiard ball model where you're passing a particle back and forth between two other particles, if you don't think of the mesotron as a particle, like in this theory, it's being passed between two particles. If you just think about it as a motion that's within that intra-atomic space, you know, it's like you have a proton surrounded by this mesotron energy, with a neutrino going around.
It's an energy carrier.
Right. It's not carrying a force back and forth, but it is carrying energy. And we use that fact that it carries energy to add 183.6 to 1,836 and get 2020. Right, it's not a particle, so it doesn't have mass, but it has energy. Yeah.
It's like a switch. Let's take the switch one way. What would be causing the switch? What would cause it to switch?
Okay, that's what I was just saying. So, the billiard ball model, you got to think about it, being passed back and forth and switching like that. But instead, think about it. Think about a neutrino going around a proton. Okay, so you're going, what makes it do that? Well, imagine this neutrino is going around a proton. It's not a charge, so it doesn't radiate. So theoretically, it would go in this orbit. Okay, and as it's going around that orbit, think of a looping motion that goes around the neutrino and then around the proton, around the neutrino, around the proton, in a spirograph fashion. If you're thinking about it, it's just an analogy, but that looping motion, when that motion is out there going around the neutrino, well, it's actually not a neutrino then, it's like an electron, and it's like you have a proton and an electron. And when it swings back in around the nucleus, then it's like the neutrino's out there, and you've got an effectively neutron. You have a proton plus this negative mesotron. Okay? That's what's doing that. Okay, it's just this motion, that encompasses the two particles. Instead of having a motion that's wrapped around one particle, it's a motion that's wrapped around the two of them together as a system. This is what all molecules and everything are. That's what you're doing, to bond atoms together into molecules. The motions aren't just around an atom. Now the motions are in the whole molecular system. Here in the atom, the motion isn't just around the particle. Some of the motion is in the whole atomic system. Okay, that's what a universe of motion allows you to have. Okay, and there can be this motion that's not just wrapped around a particle because the space between the particles is not empty. Okay, there's a medium in which like we said when we were talking about stars. There's like an effective surface of a star, and a very coupled system inside of it. Same way with an atom. Okay, so the whole region of the atom becomes like one big domain, particle-like domain, where energies can be, where motions can be.
So is the powerful and unknown energy that they mentioned in the first paragraph, is really a motion?
What it is these sub-electronic level motions. Right? The thing that we have never imagined is having something that's below the electronic level particle phenomenon, where you can have energies that aren't wrapped around a particle. In other words, motions that aren't wrapped around a particle. So they're sub-electronic. Right now, the only energy we know is what we call electronic level energy. It's when this motion is wrapped around a particle. When that motion is wrapped around a particle, it has these properties that we can measure, like mass and charge and things like that. But if it's not wrapped around a particle, if it's just within the volume of this atom, for instance, we don't even know it's there. Other than if we knew there had to be electrons, actual electrons, not magical fuzzy things like we currently believe, but we knew there had to be actual objects, and it had to be stable somehow against this decay by radiation. we could deduce the existence of this, see, logically, which is what we're trying to do here in a few short minutes.
This neutrino,
mm-hmm.
when it's a neutrino,
yeah.
is without mass, right?
It's without mass or charge.
What would make it want to go around?
Again, that's what I'm saying, because it's part of a system. See, again, don't think in a billion, okay, for those of you on the webinar, he was saying, if this neutrino is going around, what would make it go around if it doesn't have mass or it doesn't have charge? You remember, you're trying to think of it in terms of a billiard ball model, in terms of a central force model. It's like, well, it doesn't have a mass, so gravity wouldn't be pulling it towards the center. It doesn't have charge, so Coulomb force wouldn't be pulling it towards the center. No, no, it's not a system of billiard balls. It's not a universe of matter. It's a universe of motion. You have a system of motion. Okay.
Where do the ultimatons fit in?
Every one of these particles is a collection of 100 ultimatons.
Even the mesotron?
No, the mesotron's not a particle. See, that's what I'm saying. You know, back in the days that this 1940 scientific, mesotron was a particle, something that you could measure coming down in the atmosphere towards top of Pike's Peak. Okay, but the revelators don't want us to use that. Okay, that's a it's great. The revelators say it's great that you have another name for that now, pion, because we're not talking about pions holding an atom together. We're talking about something that's not a particle. Pion's a particle. You need another name. Call it mesotron. Okay, the mesotron is an energy within the atom, and it's what's holding the particles together. And it's not holding them with electrostatic force or gravity. Okay. Because this is not wholly dominated by your recognized laws of positive and negative attraction. Right? Okay? You don't have to hold billiard balls together with forces at a distance when you don't have billiard balls to hold together anymore. Okay? That's what the system is.
So it's really bugging me that they would... I mean, I get what you're saying, that they say, okay, this is how you think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But... kind of like Pam was saying, it just bugs me that they put the words down on a page
mm-hmm.
for all time, and what makes me wonder, if really they couldn't find a way to say, this is how you think of it without saying...
Again, it's going to, basically it's a, revelation mandate that, you're up against, but... Think about it you're feeling a tension because it seems like you can't trust the face value of the revelation. That you have to somehow have this insight and properly interpret it. Okay, just in this set of paragraphs. No, the entire book is that way. Okay, there's not a single word in the entire book that's a truth. Not one word in the entire book is a truth. It's a bunch of facts. You can't read the truth of the revelation. This is, this brings that to a point. If I just follow these words factually, I'm not getting truth. Well, guess what? It's not just these paragraphs. Every single paragraph in the Arantia book is like that. If you just follow the words, there's no truth. It's like, well, how do you know that? Well, in the Jesus Papers, it tells you directly in a sentence that there is no truth in words. Words are facts. This is a revelation of truth. The words are not truth. You have to figure out what flows through the words. That's the truth you're looking for. I'm trying to show you what truth flows through these words. I mean, take something that's, closer to home. Like, I don't care about mesotrons. I care about God the Father. Okay, well, go up to the God the Father papers. And over again, they tell you that in Him we live and move and have our being. Well, that's not actually correct. You can't take those words at face value. It's like, well, how do I know that? Well, when you get to the Supreme Papers, they say, well, okay, now that you're a little more advanced and sophisticated, because you've made it this far in the book, we're going to tell you you don't actually live and move within the Father. He's not personally present here. You actually live and move within the Supreme. It's like, well, you mean then those sentences up in papers 1 through 5 are false? No, they're just sentences. What did you see flowing through those sentences? The truth is still flowing through those sentences. Okay. Can you get a sophisticated enough thought process going that you can separate fact from truth. The more you understand about what the revelation is really trying to teach you, the more you'll see that every sentence in the book is an opportunity for falsehood. There isn't a single sentence in the book that you can't take too simplistically and literally, okay, and go off on a false tangent. You know, more or less distortion of meaning. Something on the webinar?
No. Just me.
Okay.
it sounds like you're like getting close to parable kind of things.
Yes. I mean, notice how this should sound familiar to you, and your consternation should sound familiar to you. The same consternation the apostles had when Jesus would tell a parable. And the apostles would be all confused. They say, "Well, I'm following your words exactly, and I'm taking them literally, Master. And you're telling me I'm not supposed to do that. Well, what the hell am I supposed to do then?" And he's saying, "Can't I use a sequence of words to get you to discover the truth that flows through them? Exactly. Have you no understanding of what the difference between truth and words is?" And of course, they didn't. All they could understand is words and simplicity. You know, they were simpletons. They were just simplistically trying to follow the words. Okay, he was giving a revelation of truth, not a revelation of words. That's why, by and large, the midwayers don't give you any of the words of Jesus. They give you their words, or Paul's words, or some other human that they found that had a nice sequence of words. Okay, they don't give you what Jesus said, because his words are not truth. His truth is truth. And you can get Jesus' truth through midwayer's words, just like Jesus was hoping that the apostles and others could get truth through his words. But the truth is not the words.
So, Chris, mm-hmm. then the flow of truth is woven between the facts. But mm-hmm. if the facts produce no truth, or there is no truth that flows through the facts, then the facts are false scripts.
Truth. Truth flows through facts. Truth doesn't flow through figments. If you find a sequence of thing-like points through which truth doesn't flow, then you know that those aren't facts. Those are figments. Okay? And it's like, well, how can I tell the difference between fact and figment? How can I tell the difference between truth and falsehood? That's what these gifts you've been given are for. You need to take the light in cultivating, being able to distinguish between fact and figment. That's your first cosmic intuition. Michael is still waiting for someone to really use the spirit of truth on the planet to actually distinguish between truth and falsehood. But we haven't gotten there yet. It's sad to record that almost no one on the planet has gotten to the point where they can use that discriminator yet, because they can't even distinguish fact from figment yet. So, you know, it's moot to have the spirit of truth. This is the difficult fact that, you know, that you have to face. You know, and again, we got to finish this up. Okay, let's finish this up here. So, but just appreciate that the way you go about this is the reason I know I have to think beyond the surface quite deeply with these paragraphs. Is if I don't, these paragraphs are in direct conflict with previous paragraphs. So I either burn the book, or I take my insight up a notch. Can I find a thread of truth that flows through these words and those words, back in the thing where they were talking about the central proton, and you could tell the nucleus was one particle. Can you find a thread of truth that flows through both the central proton sentence and the sentence that says the nucleus is composed of protons and neutrons? You can. I'm trying to point how you do that. But you've got to think dynamically, and you can't be simplistic in your approach. Yep.
One thing that I want to point out is that sometimes I've observed that you'll notice facts, data points, and you'll choose to set them aside until you feel like you have enough data points, enough information to relate them. But you don't rush with it. You just let them be and cook on the back burner for until it's time.
You do the lesson that everyone in the local system should have learned 40,000 years ago with Adam and Eve. That patience thing. Okay. You read that, that thing about the 1/2000th, that paragraph, and you're going, oh, that doesn't make any sense to me. That should say more than. Okay. But if you're patient, if you don't immediately fall into the Adam and Eve, or the Lucifer trap, and be impatient and change the sentence to match your preconceived opinion, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. If you can actually just let it be. I mean, do you know it's a revelation or not? If it's a revelation, don't change it.
Well, that's what you did on that sentence.
No. I all the words I've left, none of these words should be changed in the book. The words should be exactly the way they are.
You didn't change the truth.
Okay, I'm just showing you what truth flows through them. Notice that use it as an analogy. But the relators are giving you an analogy. The rationalization of the proton-neutron nucleus is an analogy for understanding the atom.
Keep reading it.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I talked about the energy carrier in quotes there. Make sure we got everything in there. The other thing that, maybe just one comment, that you can tell that, if you read the original article, or even if you've ever read any human writing, when they say things like superior force, mass, power, no human has ever strung those words together like that. Humans don't say things like that. Only the revelators say things like that. Force hyphen mass power. Okay? That's just nonsense from a current scientific perspective or even from a dictionary perspective. Okay? So, you can tell that they're tweaking something and they're wanting you to think outside the box a little bit. All right. Okay. Now, so that's what the revelators do with the whole block in the Scientific American article about holding the nucleus together. And then point number two in the article is about beta decay. And so they throw in this little paragraph about that.
The presence and function of the mesotron also explains another atomic riddle. When atoms perform radioactively, they emit far more energy than would be expected. This excess of radiation is derived from the breaking up of the mesotron energy carrier, which thereby becomes a mere electron. The mesotronic disintegration is also accompanied by the emission of certain small uncharged particles.
Okay, the certain small uncharged particles, those are neutrinos. Okay. This is a different thing. All that stuff we just did, that's one thing. Now another thing about the mesotron. Okay, separate issue is beta decay. This is what they're talking about here. Okay, now again, you can see how it's paralleling. Next thing he talks about in the article is beta decay, and you're going, oh, wait a minute, someone made a mistake here. Instead of saying they emit far more energy than would be expected, that should say far less energy. And actually, it probably shouldn't say more. See, so again, if the people, who've been changing the book knew more physics, they would have seen that one too, and they were going, oh, that has got to be changed. Because, if scientists see that saying far more, they're going to go, this is stupid. They don't even know about beta decay, whoever wrote this, It should be emit less energy then. Okay, that would have been changed. But fortunately, they weren't sophisticated enough to change that one. Okay, the relators again, have tweaked that. Because in the article, it's talking about less. And here they're saying more. Far more, in fact. Okay, what's the deal? When they first were studying beta decay, which is where one type of atom shifts to another type of atom of the same mass, so it can be stable. you know, like carbon 14 going to nitrogen 14, say, that radioactive decay we use for carbon dating. And they started studying that, and they noticed that there was this electron that came flying out when the atom changed from carbon to nitrogen. And so they carefully were measuring the momenta and the energies of all the particles involved, the atom before, the atom after, and the electron that went flying off. And it didn't take them long to recognize there's a big problem here. Energy and momentum are not conserved, apparently. And we thought those were definitely conserved properties. And for a while, they didn't know what was going on. Apparently, physics was not as they thought. But then they decided, well, wait a minute. Maybe what the deal is there's a particle we can't see. Now, what if there's a particle that's going flying off that doesn't have mass or charge? So it'd be really hard to detect. Okay? And it's carrying off a part of the energy and part of the momentum.
Photon?
No. We can see photons. Otherwise, this room would be dark. It's pretty easy to detect photons. I can use my eyeball. Okay? Right? So there must be a particle that's flying off, you know, that has some of the energy and some of the momentum, so that momentum and energy are still conserved. And so they hypothesized that there was this undiscovered particle, and eventually came to be called a neutrino. Okay? And it is. You know, that's the small uncharged particle they're talking about. So an electron and a neutrino fly off. Okay, see, so initially, see, the mystery was that when atoms perform radioactively, they emit less energy, but don't change that, you know, because the relativators are wanting you to think about something more. And what they're doing is they're leveraging off after the guy in the article talks about that fact that there's less energy than you were expecting, you know, and then it must be being carried off by this neutrino that we can't detect. He says, but there's even a bigger problem. He's saying, you know, where do the electron and the neutrino come from in the first place? You know, because he's thinking in billiard ball model, you know, and he's got electrons, you know, but the electrons, you know, in orbit are not flying off. This is a whole new electron that's flying off, not one of the orbital electrons, you know, and he's got protons and neutrons in the nucleus, and now he's thinking as there's mesotrons rattling around, billiard balls rattling around in there too. He's going, but none of those are, you know, are spare electrons or neutrinos rattling around and they could go flying off. Where do these two particles come from that go flying off? And that's what the revelators are trying to get you to think about. When they changed it from what you expect, less, to not only more, but far more. Because that electron and that neutrino have their electronic level properties that we measure. But they have the motions of the particles themselves that we don't measure and we aren't aware of, which are energies. That neutrino has, let's start with the electron. The electron has motion. The motion that is the charge. It's an energy. You know, all we talk about is charge. We talk about energy. But there's some energy there, energy we don't measure. The neutrino has some non-charge-like energy. It doesn't produce, you know, charge-like phenomena. It doesn't produce any mass-like phenomena. It doesn't produce anything we measure. But it's an energy. It's a motion that's part of that neutrino. It makes it a neutrino. There's a whole bunch of energy there. See, that seems to have come from nowhere. If you think about, you know, if you think more logically, if you aren't just keeping track of the electronic level energy, if you're actually thinking that there's particles and they must be some sort of an energy construct of some sort, you know, there's far more energy than you would expect. There's two whole new particles now here, okay, and in the article, and then the revelators are wanting you to pick up on that. What you have is that. That mesotron has two types of energy in it, a charge-like type and a non-charge-like type. Those two types of split and wrap around two electronic level bases and leave. half of the meson, or half of the mesotron, excuse me, sorry to say it correctly, half of the mesotron heads off as the electron, and the other half of the mesotron heads off as the neutrino.
And they just wrap around.
They wrap around electronic level bases
that are
in the environment. Yeah. Because decays are actually collisions, you know, and energy transfers.
So when you're saying mesotron, half of the, it's really the energy, it's not a particle, right?
Half of the energy goes to make an electronic level base an electron, and the other half of the energy goes to make an electronic level base a neutrino. And those two particles go flying off. Okay? And they fly off at high energy because that mesotron is motion. It's energy. Okay? So off they fly. Okay, and see the way they describe it, the energy carrier, which thereby becomes a mirror electron. This is hinting at another thing. For the particles that we observe to really have mass, they have to have a charge-like phenomenon. It doesn't have to be a net charge-like phenomenon. Like the neutron doesn't have a net charge-like phenomenon. But when you actually understand what it really is, it has charge-like phenomenon, but it cancels, and so there's no net charge. It's only particles that have no charge-like phenomenon at all that are massless, the neutrinos. When you actually have the mesotron-like energy wrapped around a particle so that it's a pion, the pion has lots of mass, because it has a charge-like aspect to it. Okay, so that's the fun thing that they're doing there. It's like, you think about the beta decay and you worry about the less than, you should be worrying about the more than, which you don't recognize. See, that's what they're doing with this. All right, then read the rest of it there.
The mesotron explains certain cohesive properties of the atomic nucleus, but it does not account for the cohesion of proton to proton, nor for the adhesion of neutron to neutron. The paradoxical and powerful force of atomic cohesive integrity is a form of energy as yet undiscovered on Urantia. These mesotrons are found abundantly in the space rays, which so incessantly impinge upon your planet.
Okay, so just they're paralleling the final things that are said in that article with those two little paragraphs. Like the very last paragraph is the last little one sentence paragraph. So you notice there. What the article talks about is, in the holding the nucleus together theory, you're passing positive and negative mesotrons, as they were called there, or pions, back and forth. And that works between a proton and a neutron. But it's, as they point out in the article, what about between two protons or between two neutrons? In order for the theory to work, you're going to have a neutral particle to pass back and forth between those. So you don't change the sign, the charge sign. And what?
But there's only one proton.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have this problem with, we're trying to hold together a multi-billiard ball nucleus, not the, in the billiard ball model of the nucleus. Okay, not in the real. Not in the real part, the real atom. Okay, this is about the imaginary nucleus that's composed of protons and neutrons. Okay, and so they recognized that way back when. And like I said, when they finally discovered pions, they found the positive ones in 47, and then the neutral one in 50. Okay, and then they had the neutral pion to pass back and forth between protons and neutrons. And you notice how they even used, when you have a charge, like the internal integrity of an object, that's cohesion. We think of an electrical, construct that's a molecular thing, that's cohesion. Whereas if it's, two objects sticking together on the outside that are neutral, that's adhesion. So you see how they use the cohesion and adhesion for sticking protons and neutrons together. Well, the interesting thing about that is, the more they they've worked with this theory of holding their nucleus together with these positive, negative, and neutral pions, as they're now called. They eventually recognized that this force isn't actually attractive between two protons and two neutrons. It's only attractive between a proton and a neutron. This nuclear force that they, you know, that they work with, still are working with. And it's why they can't glue two protons together or two neutrons together and make a diproton or a dineutron, as they call them. Because in their model, they actually discover that it's actually not quite an attractive force. It's a repulsive force when they're the same kind of particle. It's only when they're different particles that it's an attractive force. The reason is you can have the spins can be parallel when they're different particles. And it's in this model of holding the nucleus together, it's only when the spins are parallel that it's an attractive force. Okay, that's a lot of detail, but...
There are no nucleuses or whatever you want to call them, where there's just
two protons or two neutrons.
Yeah. Protons. They don't exist.
They don't exist. Oh. And they understand it through that way. But see, so in between the lines, now we understand all that. Think what the relativists are saying. See, even when you finally discover, in 1950, the neutral pion, it's not going to solve your problem. You're still not going to be able to figure out how to glue two protons together or two neutrons together. See, and then they repeat what they say. The paradoxical and powerful force. Actually, there isn't anything holding the protons and neutrons together in the nucleus because there aren't protons and neutrons in the nucleus. So it doesn't matter if it doesn't work between two protons and two neutrons. Okay? But the idea of how you've been doing this with pions... and let's go back to the mesotron name, the relativists are saying, is valid. And it works to understand how the electrons stay in orbit about the nucleus, the single particle nucleus. Okay? And, and sure enough, like I said there, see, the very last thing the author in the Scientific American article is saying, the only way that we can look for these mesotrons is in cosmic ray showers, because it's only there that the velocities are high enough to produce these things. We hadn't developed particle accelerators that were strong enough to do it then yet. And so the relativists take that statement and they say, the mesotrons are found abundantly in the space rays which so incessantly impinge upon your planet. There's not just the muons, which they were calling mesotrons back then, but there are pions too. See, and we eventually did find them abundantly in the space rays. So that's just a kind of little tip of the hat there to the revelators were, if way back, when this was first given, you could have put these pieces together, you would have gone, aha, in 1947 and 1950, sure enough, just like the revelators said, they are there. When you figured out that the mesotrons were really pions and not muons, but so that's, so all of it, all of it is just a little play upon that article to give you some things to use. Either take it directly and we're going to change this word, here's a Bible passage, but we're going to change this word, or here's something you said kind of directly. Now think of that as an analogy. What could you do with that analogy? Could you extend that analogy from your imaginary nucleus to the actual atom, which actually needs something held together. Electrons need to be held to the nucleus. That's what they've done here. All right. Should we wrap it up there? Everyone exhausted? Okay, let's take a moment here.